accession number 19777, reel 3.
Bill Norman, reel 3.
Yes, I said that these Gurkhas gave us tea. I didn't take their names, and the staff sergeant asked for his notebook, looked in it, and said, "Where are the names?" I said, "There weren't any." And he looked at me, obviously, without saying it, "You're a bloody liar." So I thought, that's how I'm going to act. Then he said, "Right, take that 1500 weight and post all those Indian other ranks at their various places along the road." So I sat in the truck. Nothing happened. I said, "Hey, where's the driver?" He says, "There isn't one. You drive it." And I said, "I can't drive." He said, "Well, you'll bloody well learn soon, won't you?" So I got in this truck and the bloke showed me what to do and we set off. We got going. This is the first time I'd ever been behind a wheel and I'm all over the road. And I reached the first bridge where there was supposed to be a policeman. An MP, that is. And there were nobody in the truck. Except one or two that all disappeared. So I said, "Where are they all?" Eventually they all came walking along the road. And I said, "What do you all get out for?" "Oh, sir, but crab driver, you're a very bad driver." And they jumped out. I said, "Oh, I'm a boat tea driver, I'm a very good driver." And laughing, and one of them says, "Sir, I'll drive the truck." So they did do. So when we got coming back near, I got back in the wheel and I purposely ran it into a tree without doing much damage, just to show them that I couldn't drive, and what's more, I wasn't damn well going to. The next time I went and saw the captain again, and because I heard that a lot was going to go back. And he ticked me off and said, "No, you're going to stay here." He could see through me, I think. And this party that were going to go back were all separated and were going to get putting their stuff on a truck. And there were one fellow that didn't want to go back because he was being separated from his chum. So I said, "Look, do you want to stay, Tom?" And he says, "Yes, I do." I said, "Well, I don't. I'll go and see the captain and see if we can change." So I dashed around the corner. I saw nobody and I came back and I said, "Yes, it's okay." So I got in the truck and went back and he stayed. When I got back, the order room sergeant says to me, "You're not on the list, Bill." And I says, "Yeah, no." And I said, "Well, I was changed at the last minute with Lister." So he says, "Oh, all right." And I never heard any more about it. And I was back with the battalion. We were reformed into the mortar platoon. There was two mortars. And we were at a place called Ligu, H-L-E-G-U, Ligu. And we set off marching towards Rangoon. I hadn't even got a pair of boots. I had a pair of flip-flops, which I'd got. There was no, in the section, we were formed into an infantry section because the mortar had gone off on a truck somewhere. And we had one rifle. It was an Italian carbine. It was a Manlica Caricani or something. And I think I had 3 clips of ammunition of 6 rounds in each, or something like that. And that was all we had, and the rest had a grenade. And I was told, "Detail someone off to take over your rifle if you get shot or become a casualty." And we set off marching down the road. And we just marched. And it seemed to go on forever. All the time there were thousands of refugees coming along out of Rangoon, Indians. And trucks with furniture piled on them. And here was us having to march. And we took a dim view of this. All our trucks too. All military transport. Then we found out that there was a roadblock put up behind us. But the, I think it was the West Yorks were going to attack on the Gloucesters. And some of the Indian battalions had just come out. And this went on all day. We were just sat there waiting, picketing the roads and starving as usual. I found a tin of treacle and a tin of butter. And I thought, well, I'm not going to let go of this. I'll hang on to it until I find something to put it, eat it with. But I'd no equipment and it was awkward carrying it. And I put my hands together, says, God, let me find an old respirator or someone's dump so I can put these and carry them. And looking on the road, there was a haversack lying in the middle of the road. God answered my prayer. And it was an answer too. It was a haversack that dropped off a truck from someone in the Gloucesters. And it contained everything I wanted other than food. A razor, toothbrush, soap, a towel, a pair of socks. That was a wonderful find. Eventually the sergeant came round to us and he got me on one side and Jack Longdon. And the other sergeant, Staniforth. And he says, look, he said, we can't break this roadblock. He says, and what they're going to do is we're going to split up in small parties, he said, and head for Akiab. He says, I want you two to come with me and we'll form a party. I thought, gosh, this is a bad situation. And it was. We didn't realise it, but we were almost on the verge of surrendering. We could not get through. The Japs had got us. But they made a big mistake too. And I won't go into all the details of it. But the party that was, I put this roadblock up, were supposed to be heading towards Rangoon, thinking that we would defend it. And they'd stopped to sort us out on the road, which they thought was a good target, and they got ordered to move on. And they just left it, left the road wide open, so the army in Burma escaped. General Alexander had just taken over, and it was his idea that we split up in small parties and infiltrate out and abandon all our equipment. Unfortunately, it wasn't necessary. We marched all night. We reached the roadblock and there was dead all over the place. And then we marched all night. And we'd been marching all day and we'd been marching all night. And that was the first time and the only time I've ever seen men marching in their sleep. You would march along and suddenly your eyes would be shut and you'd bang into the man in front of you, promptly flop down on the ground and go and fall asleep. But as soon as somebody says, get on your feet, we're moving, everybody was up quick. Nobody stayed there. Daylight came. And we hit the road again. I say we'd been marching all night. We were marching on a compass bearing. And I don't know whether we'd taken a shortcut, but somehow we'd left the road. We eventually got back to it, and trucks came and picked us up. And as we were going along, these Jap planes was machine gunning us, shooting at us, more frightening than the Jap planes was our colonel, major now, Major Faithful, Bull Faithful, army boxer, army rugby player, and he had taken charge of the battalion, and he was sat on the top of the truck with a brain gun, and every time these planes came, he rip at him, and all his empty cases came showering down on us and burning us and hitting us in the truck, and we yelled at him. And someone yelled out, "Give up, yes! Give up, yes! Bloody bull, something!" And he was most put out that someone had swore at him, and wanted to find out who it was. And I think he was more concerned about that than these Jap planes that kept machine gunning. But none of them hit us, and none of them came near us, actually. Eventually, my memory fails. I don't know where we went to, but we got out these trucks, and we slept by the side of the road. And we got into a train the next morning. And where that train went to, I had no idea. We came to a place called, eventually, Tharawaddy, where we were in the police station, and we amused ourselves by looking at the police records of all the Burmese dacoits and bad men, and there were some wicked people in Burma. And we marched on again to a place called Saigon, where we set up our mortar in a rice mill. Nothing was happening. The Japs were following us up. They would not make contact. They just kept their distance, but all the time, we didn't realize it, they were cutting through the jungles and they were outflanking us. And they were going to cut the road behind us. And there we were, all waiting to be cut off, expecting the Japs to come up the road, which they didn't. One incident I'll recall was that the medical officer came. Wonderful man, Captain O'Hara. And he said, "I'm going to give you all an injection." "What for, sir?" "For cholera." One man in my platoon, Smith again, same one, he said, "I'm not having it, I'm refusing it." And the MO says, "No, you're not." And he says, "I'm refusing it, sir." And he says, "And you can't stop me." And he said, "Oh, yes, I can." He says, "You're going to have this needle. If you don't have it voluntary, these men will hold you down and I shall give it you, because it's a cholera needle. And if you don't have this, you stand a good chance of dying." So he had it. And a strange thing was that two men died of cholera. One was the orderly room sergeant, and one was his clerk. And I often wondered who made the list out of the battalion and left his own name off. Cost him his life.
Why should they have not wanted it?
I think they wouldn't want it, because a lot of the needles in those days used to knock you out. I know the one TAB needle we got, it was so bad that you got 48 hours excused duties. But every time I had a TAB, I needed a week excused duties. You got like a fever, like having a real bad dose of flu, and your arm was in a terrible state. If anybody came near you, was frightened to death that they would just touch it. It was probably that. And he might have just been awkward. Anyhow, he got his needle. We eventually came to a place near Prome, By now we had got well organised again, and we got boots and no socks. I had my socks, but I got that used to being without them. I couldn't be bothered to wear them. I just wore boots. And we were reasonably re-equipped. But we only had two companies, about 200 to 300 men. Nearer 300, I would say. And they were formed into two companies and with two mortars. And we were told that we were going to go into the offensive. We were going to go down, attack the Japanese, and retake Rangoon. And it's to be all white troops. The reason it was to be all white troops was that we had a habit of shooting at the Gurkhas, thinking they were Japs, or so I was told. And when we went down, we would shoot at anything that moved. The Burmese were told to get out there, and anything you saw, you shot at. And this was simply because the Japanese would use take advantage of them being darker skinned, and claim to be local people and things like that. The Dukes were going to have the privilege of leading this. We didn't think much of this privilege of leading this attack. And the two companies were to go down, one on the left of the road and one on the right. We went down a good distance in trucks, then these two set off. In no time we were in trouble. We had tanks with us by now. The Japs just let us straight through and then came up behind us and put up roadblocks all the way along. So practically without firing a shot, we were cut off. And instead of us attacking them at the front, they had got us surrounded and we had to attack them at the rear to get out of it. Our right-hand company ran into very severe trouble, and the company on the left got lost and they got mixed up with the Gloucesters. The right-hand company were in a village. I must tell you that the countryside was paddy fields interspersed with the odd village along the road. And somehow we were still mortars, but we were still infantry because the mortars were separated. And as we went along, we had to clear a village. I saw somebody. I saw a man, and I thought, well, I'm supposed to shoot him. And there was an old man stood about 100 yards away. And I said, I can't shoot him like that. So I yelled out, hey, come here. And he came. And the sergeant came up. And he said, what's this? Waving a big pistol that he had. I said, there's a man here, sir. And he's waving this pistol, and this poor fellow was so terrified, he was shaking from head to foot. He fell on his knees and begged for mercy. And I thought, gosh, I hope he's not going to shoot him. And he was pointing this pistol at him. God, don't, and it was cocked. I said, oh, don't pull the trigger, for heaven's sake. Unfortunately, he didn't, and he says, go on, bug jow, run away. We always spoke to these Burmese in Urdu, thinking they would understand. And this bloke. He was too terrified to move. He couldn't. He just couldn't get up on his feet. So we left him, and he says to me, the sergeant says to me, "No, don't tell anybody about this. Keep it quiet. We should have shot him." I couldn't have shot him. I says, "Oh, no, neither could I, and I'm glad you didn't." And that showed me a nice side of the sergeant, anyhow. So, next thing, our mortars caught up and we rushed into action. We set up the two mortars. Colonel Faithful, by now he's a Colonel the Bull, gave us our targets. And sergeant said, "Where's our own troops?" "They're there, there." And he said, "Well, I'm not, can't fire on them, sir. The colonel said, "Why can't you fire on them?" He said, they're within our danger area." He says, "Well," he says, "you will fire on them." The sergeant says, "I will not." And he says, "You will fire on them. I'm ordering you." And he says, "You can't order me. They're in the safety limit, in the danger area." And he's, Bull calmed down. He says, "Sergeant," he said, "I'll take the command off you and hand it over." And the other sergeant refused to fire. So he said, "Look, I put it to you. You either shoot and cause casualties among our men, but the rest of them will get out, or you don't shoot, and the whole lot will be destroyed by the Japanese. Take your pick." So we fired. And we fired knowing that a lot of our bombs could fall in amongst our own men, which they did. But they got out. And right until recently, when I go to old comrades' meetings, people will say to me, "Oh, you were the mortars, you fired on us at Pawn Day." And I always say to them, "Yes, we fired on you, but that's why you're here now." But they never forgot it. I hear about friendly fire. The number of times we had friendly fire there on us was just unlimited. We withdrew. Luckily, we had the tanks with us, and they battled their way through the roadblocks. And all the time, enemy aircraft would come and machine gun us and bomb us. And they never seemed to cause much trouble, but you was always afraid of what they could do. Till we got to the last roadblock at Shui Don. This was one we could not break. The Japs let the tanks through, and then they cut them off. So they separated the infantry from the tanks, and the tanks couldn't come back because there's no infantry support. It was decided that the Jukes would attack some woods on the enemy's left, and we would support them with the mortars. So this was great. We fired our first round. There were two mortars, and we fired a ranging round, and it landed quite well in the place, and we kept shooting, and we fired quite a lot of bombs. And then we had to switch targets. They were going to attack this wood, and then they were going to sweep down right across our front. While this was going on, our machine gun fired at us from quite a distance, probably about 1,000 yards. And all the men dived for cover. And I yelled at them, "Get back. We're under fire." And I said, "Your job is to keep shooting. Those men in front are depending on us for cover. Keep shooting, even if it causes casualties." So we did. And while this was going on, there was still one or two tanks with us, and one of them at the back, an officer came with a big pair of binoculars, and he said, "Is that that palm trees, Corporal?" And I said, "Yes, sir." I took no notice. I thought, "Damn fool. Who's going to put a machine gun in a palm tree?" And I stopped firing, and I started to switch to my next target. And I'd no map, with no compasses, with no equipment at all. It was all guesswork. And I gave him a switch to the target and fired a ranging round. And believe it or not, it hit this bloody palm tree where this machine gun was supposed to be. I thought, God, I'm miles out. I hope I haven't landed that one on our own men. When this officer came up and he says, "Corporal, let me shake your hand. I've never seen such fine shooting." It occurred to me since that I wondered if my number one aimed at that palm tree. Because when I did switch, we were right bang on target again. In the meantime, another Jap mortar got onto us. But again, this man with the binoculars told us where it was. And the other mortar switched onto it. And this mortar never fired again. I don't know whether he got the right place or not. If he did hit it, he was damn lucky. So, we fired all our ammunition. We finished it all off with no more rounds. So we put the mortar on a truck and became infantry. And we somehow drifted into the village of Shwedon, where there was a lot of fighting going on. Just prior to going in there, the sergeant said to me, "Mick Mullany has been killed. Let's go and get his identity cards, the identity tags." So I went with him. And there was a lot of dead lying in the field. And when I went there, they were all out the Cameroonians, and there was three sections of men, 20 to 30, and there was lying out dead in their sections, one on the right, one in the centre and forward, and one on the left. And we were looking at them and thinking, God, how did they all get killed like that? And we were a bit annoyed because we looked and we saw where a machine gun had wiped a lot out. And we thought, we could have got that with our mortars. We were sat by the side of the road while this was happening. It was dark, and we couldn't shoot or range in the dark, but bloody hell, we could have done something. And I noticed among these dead that the last man, the nearest man, about 100 yards off this machine gun, had a grenade in his hand. He hadn't pulled the pin out, but he was very few more yards than he could have got it. And I also noticed that a lot of these dead were shot between the eyes. I thought, well, how did they shoot them between the eyes with a machine gun? Then it occurred to me that they'd been wounded and the Japs had